Welcome to the Indie Dev Podcast. I'm your host, Dave Voiles. West London Games is a British independent game studio founded by Russ Clark to develop the ultimate exploration and combat game, TerraTech. Russ has previously worked at London's IdeaWorks mobile studio until 2012. He developed first prototype for TerraTech by himself shortly afterwards, pulling in his experience from working on beloved franchises like Metal Gear, Call of Duty, Resident Evil, Tomb Raider, and Fable. After spending some time working as a consultant, he returned to TerraTech to prototype and turn his vision into a full-blown indie product. Russ, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Dave. Good to be here.
All right. So with that in mind, why don't we take a step back and start with how you got into programming and game development, and then we'll gradually work on to what you're creating at the moment.
Okay. Well, I'll just ramble on. Do interrupt me if I start droning and you need to move things on.
Not a problem.
I was always fascinated with computers. I can still remember when I was probably about five or six, my granddad showing me, I think it was a ZX81, and showing me writing a program in before my eyes to draw a sine curve and being absolutely mesmerized with what this thing could. I didn't even know what a sine curve was, but I knew it was awesome. I guess I got my first computer when I was about, I think, nine, and that was a BBC Micro. I don't know if they had them outside the UK because it was the British Broadcasting Corporation that made them.
Yeah, you know what it was? I read a lot of Retro Gamer magazine now, and they're out of the UK, and I noticed that you guys had way different PCs and consoles of the 80s than we did in America.
Yeah, no, I don't know if it was really a cultural thing or just a sort of accident of any kind, but the 8-bit machines that came out over here were much more focused on access to programming and kind of getting involved, whereas in other countries, a lot of them were more, you know, focused on being game consoles, even though you could still do some really cool things with them.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
But the BBC, you know, it was quite a large box, about a foot wide, and I still remember the manual that came with it. Still, I think the best manual I've ever seen with any piece of technology. And I think the whole second half of this inch thick manual was a programming guide explaining the basic language and, you know, running you through all the controls. So as soon as you got this thing, you know, you had a basically an introduction to being a programmer that came right with it.
I would like to think how much different my childhood would be if I had one of those at that point.
Well, it could be me interviewing you now, huh?
Yeah,
who knows? I mean, it was an amazing thing, and it's something that I think it's been potentially lost in to recent generations, this sort of fact that the first machine that you would get to grips with would kind of push you into making stuff yourself. And it's something that, you know, various people have been trying to bring back at various stages, like the Raspberry Pi project out of Cambridge. I think some of the guys involved in that, David Braben and so on, you know, one of the things that they were talking about was the idea of bringing back this kind of introduction to computing that happened with this old generation.
Like really low cost as well. So it's like slowly bringing down the barrier to entry to just about anybody to get started programming and computing in some sort.
Yeah, completely. So, I mean, that was my first machine. And obviously, it was bought for me by my parents with educational purposes in mind. But naturally, the thing that fascinated me immediately was video games. So I started playing games on that. And it was only after a year or two with the thing that I started messing around with what I could do and started getting excited by the idea of making stuff myself.
Oh, yeah. And you can see, like, today, that's kind of grown onto a lot of developers. And I think that's why so many of us get into game development, console development, largely because we had these, you know, childhoods where you were enamored by the games you were playing. And now we have the ability to make games for consoles and all these platforms, and it's kind of blowing everybody's mind.
Absolutely, yeah, and it's really interesting to see how that transition's gone. It became harder and harder, I think, over the time, the 16-bit era and beyond, for people to just sort of dive in and mess around with making video games, because the technology got more and more complex and required more and more knowledge to get involved with it. And then we've come back to this time recently with products like Unity and the many other Game Maker and RPG Maker and all these other things that are available these days. We've come back to a time where it's probably as easy as it's ever been to actually get into game development and produce things for other people to consume.
Oh, absolutely.
So yeah, my first computer was the BBC, and some of the classic games, I played on that, things like Elite, were just inspirational. Actually, the game that I always cite as possibly my favorite game ever was a game called Exile that not so many people have heard of these days. I think they released it later, a version of it for the Amiga.
Exile, let me see this.
Yeah, it was originally an 8-bit game for the BBC, and it's kind of a Metroidvania game. I think it was actually maybe a year or two after the first Metroid, or it may have been the second
Oh
Metroid.
yeah, definitely. It's a little astronaut taking place in space. Really crude sound effects.
Yeah, totally. Although on the extended version that you got, if you had a BBC with some extra memory in it, they had a sort of a really bad sort of voice box sound generation thing that could sort of howl in a way that was just about recognizable as a
Yeah,
word.
that must be the version that I'm watching on YouTube right
Yeah.
now. Guy's like shooting particles out of his butt as he's flying around.
Yeah, totally. Totally. It was a fascinating game, because, it was an open world kind of thing, where, you would just explore and work out where you could go, and much in the format of games like Super Metroid. And you would have to find things to allow you to unlock new areas, but quite unlike anything else really that was around at the time, certainly that was available to me. And it just blew my mind because it was so far ahead of its time. There's still fan sites that go on about all the crazy things they did to make that game work. That you shouldn't have been able to have a game like that on that computer.
Right, like it took dedication in the 80s and early 90s to get some of these PC games going.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the industry's always been moved forward by just crazy, unbelievable barrier breaking that did things no one thought was possible. I mean, that reminds me of things like Doom, another game which I remember just being a huge fascination at that time of my life. The sort of thing that just expanded your mind really, and fascinated you with something you had to get involved with.
Oh yeah, absolutely. So you got started with BBC Micro playing games, and did that gradually lead into your education, and that's how you learned to program, or were you really self-taught at that point?
I was pretty much self-taught. I had that manual that came with it, and I would mess around with programs and see what I could do. I didn't really have much of a work ethic in my teens, so I didn't really manage to get many finished projects out there. Funnily enough,
I think most of us were like that, definitely.
possibly the best thing I ever made on the BBC, I think, was actually a tool. I was determined that I was going to make a version of Street Fighter for the computer, and so I made
Oh,
myself.
'cause that's pretty easy, right?
Yeah, I thought, you just get some guys moving around. What can be so difficult? And the first thing I did was to make basically a sprite editor, for mocking the characters up. There was a particular mode on the BBC that was a bit more efficient, where what you would it was a, it was a rather arcane trick, but you could make sprites that were actually fonts. You could do a programmable font, and it was a very fast way of rendering. And I so I made this
It's like a
tool.
little cheat, a little workaround to get something done.
Totally, yeah. So I made this thing, and I was kind of drawing knockoff Street Fighter characters into probably like 12 pixel high fonts, and
Right,
yeah. As you can imagine, I didn't get very far with the actual game, but the tool was kind of nice.
and I'm sure you learned a little bit along the way, and then you also learned how to scale your game development, right? You can't.
Yes.
I guess you learned not to make something so grand and so large as your first product.
Yes, an early lesson in getting carried away with scope.
So you did that, and then you got it. I guess So you worked on some of these larger franchises in the 90s and even up to recent time, huh? Like Metal Gear, Call of Duty.
Yeah, I mean, so my very first games job after college was actually working on Carmageddon 2.
Oh, great. I had that as well.
Yeah, that was my first proper job. The guys at Stainless on the Isle of Wight, a place that most people outside the UK don't actually know where it is.
Yeah, I don't know where it is, but I was well aware of the game.
It's
Apocalypse Now.
that's right, that's right. So yeah, so after college, I was in that phase that a lot of people are in when I didn't really know what I wanted to do, but I did know that I liked video games. So I sent my CV around a few places, and only a couple of games companies got back to me actually, and one of those was Stainless. And when the recruiter phoned me up, I remember saying, "Well, I don't really feel like going to the Isle of Wight. It's an island in the English Channel, for those who don't know. And so it's not directly connected to the mainland, which is a bit of an emotional sort of hurdle to get over. I didn't
Yeah,
really see
definitely.
myself moving down there, but the guy said, just go down and meet them, just do that for me." So I said, "Okay, what the hell? They're paying
That sounds like a
expenses."
nice opportunity to get started in the games industry as well.
Well, so it proved to be. So I went down to the island, and the guys immediately bowled me over with just how crazy they were. I felt very foolish because I turned up in a suit.
And they're wearing shorts and t-shirts and hats.
Pretty much, yeah. Most of my interview was conducted in the pub, after I'd sat down and played Carmageddon for a while.
Well, that's not a bad start, huh?
Yeah, and that was kind of typical, really, of them. And so I was there for the next 3.5 years, Carmageddon, and then, well, a whole bunch of stuff that didn't get released, which was quite a common thing in the industry
That's
at
always
that
fun,
time.
right? Yeah, I've worked on some of those.
Hard times. And then, I moved around a bit, a few different places, and I ended up at IdeaWorks in 2005. Having been out of games for a little while, and I'd got involved in mobile software at a company in Glasgow. And I realized after a couple of years of that I just couldn't cope with not having my creative itch getting scratched.
Yeah, exactly.
So I found this company, IdeaWorks, that at that time was actually one of the first companies in the world to be writing. There were a lot of companies doing games on mobile, but they were mostly Java games. And they were certainly the first company that I had heard of that was doing native games in coding in C++ for mobile phones at the time. This was obviously a few years before iPhone. So you were talking
Yeah, I
about.
only played a handful of those. Did you ever play the Doom RPG?
I didn't
There
actually know.
was like a there was like the really the only mobile game I played before, the iPhone really came out. It was basically Doom, but turn-based in an RPG. It was kind of absurd, but it worked out really well.
There were some funny things around at that time. I remember going to GDC once in about 2006, and there was what is now the sort of summits day, the mobile and other summits day on the first 2 days.
Yes.
They had that in a very small form, and all the noise, in mobile games was about a Java game called Skipping Stone, a one button game where you had a
It was like the Flappy Bird of its day.
pretty much, I think, and they managed to get something like 1 million downloads or something, which was just unheard of, in those times, and that was the big noise. But this company, IdeaWorks, that I had just joined, they were doing full 3D games, software rendered, on for devices like the Symbian Series 60 phones at the time. So they were kind of way ahead of everyone else, while the rest of the industry was doing Java games, and it was pretty exciting.
So you keep going. I'm
So I
sorry.
remember I went down to work for them. A friend of mine, an old college friend of mine, was working there, and I thought it was pretty exciting to be doing video games on mobile. And I remember at the end of my first week, there was a company stand-up meeting where they announced some secret deals that they'd been working on, and the two titles that they announced were Final Fantasy and Metal Gear Solid. And after I'd
Kind of hard to turn down those franchises, right?
right, so I picked my jaw up off the floor, and I realized that I was in the right place.
Yeah, I'll say.
And yeah, it took a little while. Actually, the Final Fantasy project was already starting at that time, and I worked on a few other things at the company. but I was basically lined up to then lead the code team on Metal Gear Solid Mobile, which started about 6 months later. And that, I think, remains the longest mobile project that I've ever worked on, because I think the development was about 18 months.
Wow, that's a definitely a long time for a mobile game.
Yeah, I guess maybe some things are starting to get to that time, that sort of these days. But back then, it was a funny one, because the deal was done on the basis of the fact that IdeaWorks had some pretty amazing software rendering technology at the time, which was, what enabled us to get these big IPs. And I think, Konami were interested in what could be done with it, but they didn't really know what we would do, and we didn't know exactly what we were going to do. So it was kind of an exploratory project. I remember we did so many prototypes and different versions of the game. We made about three sort of complete different games at different stages, just to sort of demonstrate what we could do and try to get Kojima-san to approve. The actual very first demo that we did for that, which we spent a few months on, almost stood up as a little game in its own right, and that was a game where it was about mini games. It was you would take Snake and you would go through this sort of small level, and there would be a bit where you had to balance across this narrow beam using an accelerometer to detect your tilt.
And this was years ago. I mean, because I guess you guys are targeting the N-Gage, so it was 2008-ish, maybe?
Well, it was kind of contemporaries of that. So there were actually two N-Gages, two sort of eras of N-Gage. There was the original device itself, the kind of really funny shaped one that looked like a slice of cheese. And it was just after that was sort of waning, was around the time that we started on that project. And then they reinvented it a few years later as a software platform.
Oh, okay. And this was when it was using Symbian and everything else.
That's right, yeah. Well, I think the early one may have been a version of that, but it was much earlier. The company IdeaWorks had done games on the N-Gage. There was a Tomb Raider game, which was basically a port of the PlayStation code, which was quite amazing.
Wow. Yeah, especially when you consider it wasn't that long beforehand that Tomb Raider was out on the consoles.
Yeah, quite, yeah. Yeah, there was some cool stuff they did at IdeaWorks. Anyways, so yeah, we had this sort of experimental project, Metal Gear Solid Mobile, where we were just kind of showing Konami what we could do and seeing what they would like. And that meant that we were able to do some quite groundbreaking things on it, really, just because we came up with them. For example, in the game when we released it, we actually had a free look feature where you would move the camera around. You would move the device around, and through grabbing preview images from the back facing camera on the back of the phone, we could do some vector analysis on the preview image and work out which way you were moving the phone. So it kind of felt a bit like using an accelerometer, except a pretty unreliable one.
Hey, but it was there before accelerometers really, before we really had access to all those things like we do today.
That's right, yeah. And so we had a first person look mode so that you could look around as a snake in that. And we also had a feature to dynamically recolor his sneaking suit, a sort of camouflage thing, where you would take a little photo and it would work out the dominant color in the photo and then recolor Snake. And we had a puzzle where you had to get past some cameras, that by changing to the same color as the wall. And you'd have a red wall or a green wall or something behind it and have to sneak along. It's quite fun.
Jeez, so you've had quite a bit of experience before you started working on the title you're working on now. So now we've covered quite a bit of that. Why don't we move on to your current project and give us a little bit of insight about that?
Yeah, so basically, when I left IdeaWorks in 2012, I did so, although I was contracting for a while. The aim was really to put together a studio and take advantage of this unique opportunity we have at the moment, to get something interesting to market. And so in between jobs, I was experimenting with different prototypes and just trying to find something that would take. And TerraTech was actually the first of those prototypes, even though it wasn't the first that I tried to get funding for. It was one that I started messing around with in the late in the year 2012, and it was a bit of a fun project. A friend and I, have been playing a game called Captain Forever, which is a sort of 2D space game, a bit like Elite, but in two dimensions, with this kind of block building mechanic for putting together a ship, and then the ship would move according to where you'd put the thrusters and so on. A really nice little browser game in 2D, and we were talking about what could you do if you did that in three dimensions. And I started messing around with this prototype, and it was kind of fun, but I didn't really have a solution to the problem of how to actually build the thing, because it's much harder in three dimensions than in two.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So I put that down for a while and started on a prototype for another game that I had, which was going to be more of a sort of character-based world exploration and crafting and game. Actually based on an idea I'd had many years before from a game called Miner Dig Deep that was an
Yep, I've
Xbox
heard of that.
arcade title. Right. I had this idea for a game I really wanted to make from it, and unfortunately Terraria came out and basically was exactly the game I wanted to make, and Minecraft was around the same time or slightly earlier, and so it was a bit foolish of me to spend a lot of time on a prototype for a game in this genre when, as soon as I started trying to show it to people, everyone immediately started asking about Minecraft, and it was quite hard to get across this idea of something being a bit different to that. So I learned a few lessons, and then around the summer of what was 2013 now, having sort of come back empty-handed from GDC, I thought I'll pick up this old prototype and, I'll just see if I can solve that building problem. And within a couple of weeks, I had that pretty much nailed. And the first kind of eureka moment with it was when I'd got the drag and drop building working, and I had a way of saving out the vehicle designs that I'd made, and I was able to just quickly make about 50 different designs, and it was loads of fun, seeing how they drove and how they fell over and what happened when you fired the guns and so on.
Oh yeah, definitely. That's half the fun of prototyping is seeing what works and what doesn't, and just the bugs along the way.
Sure. So the great thing was that I suddenly had this thing where you could, in the game, you could build a vehicle and see how it performed, and then save it and load it up later. And at that point, I knew that, there was something that was really fun here that was worth exploring further. So then it was a case of looking around to find people to get involved. And I met my co-founder, Vincent Schurer, shortly after that, who's one of the founders of the Tiger, the trade body in the UK, called Tiger, and he's actually a lawyer. He's been working in the industry for a number of years, and had been looking for a good project to get involved in from the business administration side. He liked it immediately, and so that was my first bit of really positive validation on the idea itself. And so we formed a company, and I went about trying to find people to work with me.
And how would that go about? Because often you hear that indies have a difficult time getting people on board, largely because of funding issues or basically the scale of the projects. Was it difficult for you to find other people to join your team?
It is difficult, and you do depend on luck a little bit. We had a spot of luck. Well, it doesn't sound like luck. It wasn't lucky for a lot of people, but that was that the studio Blitz Games, based in Leamington, actually had some trouble at that point, and they had to, well, basically they went bust, and they were
I
able
know,
to.
I know. That's a sad story too, because they had a lot of great people over there.
It was sad. They kept on a good team, I think about a third of them, and it's a hard time for everyone else. And a lot of really exciting stuff has now come from that environment, from all the people who are doing other things now. And the loss was our gain, because we were able to get involved with this guy, Jolyon Webb, who was the R&D art director at Blitz, and who really liked the project that we and got involved. So we suddenly got a really experienced art director, which was massively helpful in allowing
Yeah, I
us to
bet.
define the visual look of the game.
Yeah, because really, that's the first thing that anybody sees or witnesses when they're playing a game. It can really differentiate what you offer as opposed to a lot of the other games out there in the stores.
Absolutely. That was a huge help. And we were able to put together a little bit of seed funding from friends and family just to we came up with a strategy, and that was basically that it was going to take a reasonable amount of money to do justice to this game. So we would try and get together a small amount of cash in order to then secure larger funding, and we would spend the small amount on mainly on paying contractors to help us get some quite polished assets in the game. To put together a nice demo that we'd take out to GDC and use to try and secure some funding. So that's basically what we've been doing since last October, I guess, that we started getting people involved. And we've been gradually getting involved with different people and adding people to the team. The latest addition actually being the friend that I mentioned with whom I was playing Captain Forever back in the original. Times. That's Chris Scalorn, who's coming on board as our lead designer.
Oh, beautiful. So has he joined yet, or he's just about to come on?
He is joining right now. He's coming to
Oh,
us
nice.
from Future Games at London, and he's been in mobile as well for the last 6 years. So,
Oh, so he's very familiar with the space at this point.
absolutely. Now, one of the things that I've been talking about to a lot of people recently is that TerraTake is not actually a mobile game. So it's being an interesting discussion point that we've got a lot of this mobile experience coming in, and we're actually not making a mobile game in the first instance. And
Okay, so what are you targeting right now? Which platform specifically?
so we're probably going to launch it on Steam.
All right.
There are a lot of reasons for that. The problem with competition and discovery on mobile is the main reason why we don't think it's realistic for a new startup like ourselves to just kind of pile in there and try and be heard amidst all the noise. Steam, in comparison, has a much lower amount of traffic in terms of just the raw number of releases that come to the platform. And we also think that with this kind of concept, where it's very expressive and it's a lot to do with messing around with a basic system of rules and seeing what you can come up with, we think the PC audience really is a good choice for that. We think it'll go down well with those kind of people, because what we're looking to do really is build an early community of folks, who are into experimentation and who are open to the idea that the game's going to evolve. To really help us kind of find a way forward with it.
Okay, so it sounds like you guys made quite a bit of progress there.
Yeah, it's going really well. We took the game to GDC, and last weekend we took it to another show in the UK called RESD, which is up in Birmingham in the NEC there. That was actually the first chance that we've had to give the game to people to outside the team to play.
To really like publicly showcase it.
Absolutely, yeah. So we had 3 days of people just coming along and sitting down to see what they could do, and that went really well. We were obviously a bit nervous at the outset. You don't know what's going to happen when
Yeah,
real life
definitely.
people play your game. But
They say no plan survives first contact with the enemy, right?
yeah, and I certainly didn't. I was
But
doing
so part of the learning experience, you know?
definitely, definitely, and we learned a lot from it. And one of the
Bet.
things we learned that was just really good was that people like the game, because you
Okay.
never know until you've actually put it in front of people.
Yeah, really, because it's really just your eyes and hands that have been exposed to it for so long that you kind of start to get attached to products and sometimes you forget about what is or is not good about the product.
That's so true. That's so true. So it was great to see that despite, the rough edges and the occasional crash, people could get to grips with it. And it was really exciting, actually, because this game is all about modular content and building things in different ways. It was awesome to see people at the show just doing things with the building blocks that we never even thought about, and using them in ways that they weren't intended for.
Oh yeah, I mean, other people's creativity is like half the fun of it.
Right, and especially with a game like this, that's all about that creativity. It was so affirming to see people coming up with weird creations and, almost finding a way to achieve things that we'd wanted to do but hadn't implemented yet in the game.
Oh yeah, and developers would be silly at this point to not include some sort of creative mode or creative content for players. I mean, just look at how large the Minecraft or voxel style games are becoming because people can generate their own content. And additionally, you look at the consoles now, which have the ability to stream content through sources like Twitch TV. I mean, it's really only get bigger and bigger as time goes on at this point. Would you agree?
Absolutely. I think I think Twitch TV and the rise of streaming has been probably the most interesting development in the industry in the last couple of years. You know, a lot of attention gets devoted to things like Oculus Rift and VR and so on, and that stuff's all very cool. But you know, that stuff's been developing actually for a long time, so it's great to see it moving forward.
It goes into the limelight, goes out, comes in, goes out.
Right, but if you'd said to me 2 years ago that thousands or millions of people would join a stream where they would watch one person playing a game, I would just have laughed at you. You know, it's amazing that what's happened with Twitch, and that's something that we really want to get involved in.
Yeah, and you know, sometimes you'll see, well, in recent news, you've seen that larger studios will have takedown notices because they don't want their games, you know, being played and shared for whatever reason. Whereas other studios have really started to embrace it, right? And they said, look, this is an opportunity to really touch base with your consumers and the press and find out what works, what doesn't work, and you know, understand creative ways of sharing. But personally myself, I use that as a tool for finding new games. You know, you'll follow a select few Let's Players because you really enjoy their content and commentary, and I find out about other games that way, and I start to purchase them myself.
Yeah, it's absolutely huge. And so, you know, we determined from quite the early stage on TerraTech that because we had a concept that is expressive, we really wanted to push in that direction and make something that people could mess around with and something where it would be fun to watch other people messing around. So that's definitely sort of our ethos with it. We actually did our first Twitch stream yesterday, me and Chris sitting there. It was pretty funny in the end. You know, it wasn't very well rehearsed, and we had some amusing crashes in the middle. But
well, that's the fun of it, you know.
Yeah,
that it's all people thinking on their toes and having to work fast.
Yeah, it's actually quite enjoyable. I have to say, we're looking forward to doing a few more of those and seeing what happens.
Yeah, definitely. Like I said before, it's a great way to learn from your audience too, and see, you know, where their eyes and mind are at the moment.
Completely.
So, how much more time do you have on this game before you really can do like an early release or a green light or anything of that sort?
Well, green light is already taken care of. We showed the game to the guys at Valve, and they loved it, so we're okay for that.
Beautiful.
Yeah, that's really nice. So what we're probably shooting for is an early access release. We think it's the kind of game that's going to work well in early access, you know.
Okay.
And we're looking to about October for that. We've got a few months of work. You know, we really have to extend the engine quite a lot and put in some more content, because the game is all about having a lot of little pieces of content that you can put together in interesting ways. So that's going to take us some time.
Plus any sort of promotion along the way too.
Absolutely, yeah. What we want to do as well is engage with the community and really build up an audience of people steadily over time, so that when we get to that early access, there's lots of people involved. And we may even be able to release some playable builds that people can mess around with before then. It's one of the things that we're talking about at the moment.
Oh, awesome. Okay, so it looks like a fall timeline. Do you plan on presenting any other shows like PAX? Well, actually, we have PAX next week, and then we have PAX Prime in August.
Yeah, so not PAX next week, but PAX Prime is a possibility. We don't have any sort of firm plans. We're just kind of recovering from the last couple of shows. Well, we're at one next week, actually. We're at the Gadget Show Live in Birmingham, UK, next week. But apart from that, we need to kind of gather ourselves and look at our schedule. But we'll definitely be out for some of the other shows. And PAX Prime is one of the ones we're looking at for sure.
Beautiful, beautiful. So now that we're starting to wrap things up over here, I'm going to close things down with the same format that I do for all the other shows. Our previous developer we had on was James Parker from Opposable Games, and he's a creator of Savage Game, coming out very soon. And he asked a question, and it was, do you think that the Oculus or other VR tech are dangerous cul-de-sac, a dangerous cul-de-sac of potential, or should we worry? I think he's worried specifically that games and developers are really going to start focusing all of their efforts on VR, and where does that leave us?
I don't really see the danger. I haven't actually had a proper go with an Oculus yet, so I haven't had that sort of transformative moment that people talk about when they feel like their life has been changed, or when they throw up in a bucket, as it seems to be happening quite
Oh,
a lot.
that's me. Yeah, I'm one of those guys.
Like I said before, I think it's really interesting, but I don't necessarily see how Oculus or the new Sony one Morpheus represents a huge new opportunity. It's something that's been around for a while, and it comes up every so often. And it's a I think a limited subset of games that can really benefit from the real potential there.
Yeah, really, because you're really somewhat limited in to first person experiences for the most part.
So I think we're going to see some really cool things happening, and I think the audience will grow steadily. Obviously, there's a big peripheral purchase to be made, and not
A bit of a
everyone,
cost barrier to get
right,
in.
there's a cost barrier, and not everyone wants to strap on a headset in order to play some gaming, so there's that as well.
No. Yeah, we saw that televisions didn't really take off in terms of 3D adoption either.
So I think well, quite so. That's been around for a while, but it's not really exploded. So I think we'll see a niche form and grow. And the question is really, will it become something that every AAA game developer feels they need to incorporate in some way? I don't know. I doubt it. I think it'll grow steadily.
Yeah, I kind of see things in the same way. I think at the moment it's really just a lot of developers getting excited for it, understandably so, and seeing where the first initial batch of developers really start to take direction. So now we've had that question out of the way. Do you have a question for the next developer who comes onto the show?
I'll bite. So there was a lot of talk recently when Twitch Plays Pokemon was a thing.
Yes.
That was pretty interesting to watch. I spent probably a couple of hours in total actually staring at that, wondering slightly why I was, but fascinated.
Yeah, you and I both.
How long is it going to be before someone takes that concept, the idea of very many people playing a single player game or a game where all the action is focused in on one thing, collaboratively? How long is it going to take for someone to make a new game that is based entirely around that concept? And what might that game look like?
That is actually a very clever question. I was wondering that as well. I was working at a hackathon a few weeks ago with a bunch of college students, and the entire time they had this up on a projector. It was, the kids playing Pokemon. In the back of my mind, I was thinking the same thing too. Like, somebody is sitting on a gold mine right now and can't wait to jump on this. I guess really the big part is how do you get people to adopt it, right? Because Pokemon is large, a very popular franchise. So millions of people are already aware of it, but now I guess you've got to find a creative way of getting a new audience onto your game.
I think there's a huge appetite there. I mean, after Twitch Plays Pokemon went big, I remember looking up on Twitch and seeing about 50 different streams for Twitch Plays various different games. Most of them with not so many people on them, but still, it feels like there's just a huge thing there waiting to be explored.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I agree. All right, well, thank you very much, Russ, for joining us this week. I'd love to have you back on the show again once your game's actually released so that we can learn from what you learned along the way, both good and bad.
Thanks, Dave. Awesome to be here, and yeah, we'll definitely be up for that.
Okay, so how can people get in touch with you or find you, whether it's Twitter or your webpage? What's the best way to find you?
Sure, so we've got all those things. There's a web page, it's www.terratechgame.com, and we are on Twitter as at terratechgame. Again, that's TerratechGame, and you can find me on Twitter. My personal handle is at underscore Higakun, which is spelt Higekun.
Okay, you've got to explain that one.
In Japanese, it basically translates as beardy.
Oh, okay. Perfect. I figured it had to be something foreign that I wasn't aware of.
It is worthy of explanation, as you say. So you can find me there, and you can find us on our Twitter feed. We have a Facebook page as well. It's I think the Facebook tag is just Terratech, facebook.com/ I forget exactly, but You can find it if you search for that. But the best thing to do is check out our website and find us on Twitter. I know, okay, it is just facebook.com/TerraTechGame. So I got that wrong.
Oh, thank you again, Russ, for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks again, Dave.
Have a nice one.
Cheers. We'll be right back.